Islamic law. Before him, he gave of his life so publicly, a sacrifice to gather around, and in every direction you could just hear the sound of millions of people chanting as one, as black smoke and oil blocked out the sun. Over and over, a thousand will rise. And on his last morning he said, though soon I may be dead, most people can't go to a shelter, so I don't need one
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Iranians and Shia from around the world have come to the Grand Masala Mosque in Tehran and their tens of millions to observe funeral commemorations for the late Supreme Leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Khamenei was assassinated in a sneak attack February 28, 2026, during peace negotiations. The United Nations and Israel claim joint responsibility for the bombing that killed the Iranian political and Shia spiritual leader, along with his wife, daughter, son-in-law, infant granddaughter, and an indeterminate number of Iranian officials. Dmitry Lascaris is a journalist, activist, lawyer, broadcaster, and co-founder of Canada's Disruption Network. His online show, Reason to Resist, is available on Rumble, YouTube, and at Substack, along with his many articles focusing on Western government criminality. Dmitry spent the last couple of years focused especially on the collective West's destruction in West Asia. Dmitry's traveled to Iran to witness and record the remarkable demonstration of support for the late Iranian leader. Welcome back to the program, Dmitry.
Thank you, Chris. Good to talk to you again.
It's always great to have you, Dmitry. The last time you were there, this is the second time this year, the shooting war was underway, and now the shooting has started again. What's the situation there where you are right now?
Well, I'm in the holy city of Mashhad, which is in the northeastern corner. Bombardments that took place over the past 24 hours, according to reports I've seen, were all focused on the Persian Gulf Coast, Strait of Hormuz, and the Sea of Oman coast of Iran, which is at the opposite end of the country, the southwestern end of the country. So we're very close here, actually, to the border, the borders of Turkmenistan and Afghanistan. So far, there's been no reports that I'm aware of bombing in this area, and I have not seen any reports of that. However, because tomorrow is the last day of the seven-day funeral program for the martyred Supreme Leader, and given the record of depravity of the United States and Israel, I would not exclude the possibility that they'll strike some targets in the vicinity. I don't think they would be so outrageous as to strike the funeral. I think they might strike targets in the area simply to disrupt the proceedings.
Why did this ceasefire break down?
Well, let's look at the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding. The Memorandum of Understanding has significant language around the Strait of Hormuz. And frankly, it's not particularly clear as to what the status of the Strait of Hormuz is supposed to be during this period. The one thing that is clear is that Iran is not supposed to charge fees during the 60-day negotiation period, and there's no evidence that it's attempted to do that. And it also implies that it will begin to charge fees after the 60-day period. It implies it quite strongly, actually, but we're still in the 60-day period. Now, the second thing is the MOU contains a clause which says that both parties will maintain the status quo during the 60-day period. And at the time that the MOU was signed, the status quo was that Iran was firmly in control of the Strait of Hormuz and had established that any vessels going through it would have to do so with the permission of the military of Iran. And finally, there are a number of clauses under the MOU that the United States has repeatedly violated before we get to the last 48 hours. For example, it has not unfrozen Iranian assets. It has not forced Israel to withdraw from Lebanon. It has not even forced Israel to stop killing civilians in Lebanon or in Palestine, which is another front covered by the MOU. It has Trump has repeatedly threatened to use force, which is a violation of the explicit provisions of the MOU. And there are arguably other violations. So already going into the last 48 hours, Trump was violating the agreement six ways from Sunday. So what happens during the last 48 hours, as the country here is preoccupied with the funeral of the martyred supreme leader, a number of vessels associated with the Gulf autocracies, which are, of course, wholly subservient to Washington, tried to transit the Strait of Hormuz without Iranian military permission using this lane that hugs the coastline of Oman, and it's come to be known as the Omani lane. And Iran gave them a warning, said if there'll be consequences if you try to go through there without our permission, and they disregarded the warning. So Iran fired upon them and hit anywhere from 2 to 5 vessels. One was Qatari, one was Saudi. They didn't kill anybody. They didn't cause any catastrophic damage, but the message was received loud and clear. And at that point, the United States retaliated, although really it was Iran that was retaliated in the first instance. But and the United States went far further than Iran did. They struck land-based targets in Iran, and they killed people, or they killed at least one official of the Iranian military, and they wounded a number of civilians. And then the Iranians, predictably, anybody would have known who's been watching over the past several months, that they were going to strike U.S. military bases in the region and do so hard. And they hit at least the naval base of the U.S. in Bahrain repeatedly and the air base in Kuwait. And then Trump said the MOU is over. So where we are now, Chris, is the entire thing is broken down. I don't know whether we're going to return to the savagery we witnessed at the hands of Israel and the United States in March and April. But I think there's a high risk that Iran is going to strangle, is going to throttle traffic through the Strait of Hormuz as a protective measure. And already it was only up to, it had improved, but it was only up to about 20 to 25% of pre-war levels. So the global economy is in dire straits right now. And this is all the result of the aggression and the cheating and the treachery of the Trump and Netanyahu regimes.
Well, the president, President Trump, is in Turkey, in Ankara. There's a NATO confab going there. It's basically a coming out party for the militarization, the further militarization of the Western world in preparation for who knows what. He made no bones about attacking Iran ruthlessly, as you describe, actually, that doesn't matter. I don't mind telling you. I'm loosely paraphrasing here, but he's saying, well, usually I wouldn't reveal this, but we're going to hit them very hard tonight, harder than we did yesterday. And I don't mind telling you, because there's nothing they can do about it. This is Trump sitting with Mark Rutte, the NATO's head.
Yeah, well, anyone who is paying attention, even the U.S. corporate media, acknowledged that the Iranian military rendered perhaps as many as 15 U.S. military bases in the region inoperable, caused billions of dollars of damages during the hot phase of this war. The Iranians shot down well over 15, 20 advanced U.S. Drones. They claimed they shot down another MQ-9 Reaper drone today. They shot down F-16s. They shot down an A-10. There was that debacle in the desert outside of Esfahan, in which they claimed the American military that they were saving a pilot whose name has never been revealed to us. That was an utter humiliation for the United States. So it's obvious that Iran can do quite a bit without even closing the Strait of Hormuz. If it chooses that option, then the United States economy is potentially going to be hit by the economic equivalent of a nuclear bomb. And they haven't even played the Bab al-Mandeb Strait card yet. But that's the strait from the Red Sea into the Gulf of Aden, another extremely important choke point in this region. So Trump is hallucinatory. it's amazing that anybody listens to this man. And I frankly wonder whether he actually believes his own rhetoric.
Well, he did claim, too, during this same press conference, that the Islamic Republic of Japan had fired 111 rockets at the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln.
I didn't know that. That's quite a statement.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And one can only imagine how the press corps received that dutifully at this confab. But I'll grant him, he's got a very high stress job and he's an elderly fellow, that he meant to say Iran did this and not Japan. Maybe he couldn't read the prompter properly. But has the Iranian defense infrastructure, have they fired on American warships too?
I've not seen reports on in the last 48 hours that they've done so. I would imagine that they haven't, that they're out of range. They have suffered damage, the American Navy. They've lied about it. We don't know exactly how badly their ships were damaged. We know, for example, that when they were in the Red Sea, they lost a number of advanced aircraft. They claimed that they fell off the deck of an aircraft carrier. I think they were F-18s, but that was scarcely believable. There are lots of strong hints that when they were within range of Iranian drones and missiles, that they sustained serious damage. And so I think they've just kept them beyond the range of the munitions of Iran. But the military bases, Chris, are sitting ducks. They're absolute sitting ducks. There was a CENTCOM, the former commander of CENTCOM, revealed that several years ago, I think it was under the Obama and Biden administrations, he lobbied heavily for the United States military to move its military bases westward to the Red Sea coast of Saudi Arabia and to Israel, because he believed, and these were prophetic views, that those bases in the Persian Gulf are indefensible.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dmitry Lascaris. Dmitry is a journalist, activist, lawyer, broadcaster, and co-founder of Canada's Disruption Network. His online show is Reason to Resist, found on Rumble, YouTube, and at Substack. He is in Iran right now for the second time this year. You were at the commemorations in Tehran a few days ago. You've put up several posts. Can you give me a visceral idea of what it was like to be there in Tehran at this commemoration and what it looked like?
Sure. Certainly, I wanted to come here, Chris, because I wanted to see with my own eyes how the Iranian people would respond to the murder of the martyred supreme leader, and also his daughter, his son-in-law, and his beautiful 14-month-old granddaughter, whose name or photograph are never disclosed to the media. Even her age is not disclosed to the media in the West. The reason why I thought that was important, of course, is because the pretext for all of the aggression that the West has shown to, well, there are two pretexts. One is that Iran was on the verge of developing a nuke, which is demonstrably false and utterly laughable. And the second one is that it was extraordinarily evil, and that if the Iranian people were given the slightest opportunity, they would gleefully overthrow the government and install into power somebody who was well-disposed towards Washington. That was the whole justification for all of the aggression, not just these two wars of aggression from June of last year and March. So I came here to find out if this was true. And I went to the, just so you have an overview of how this unfolded, on Friday of last week, the bodies lay in state in a private setting for dignitaries and world leaders to come and pay their respects. And representatives of over 100 countries came, including senior officials from the Russian and Chinese governments. And the prime minister of Pakistan came, Georgia, Azerbaijan, their leaders came, their heads of state, over 100 countries. And that was closed to the public and only very select media. Then the next day, the bodies lay in state at the Masala Mosque in central Tehran, the biggest mosque in Iran. And it was open for public viewing, I think, for 24 hours. The following day, there was a prayer in the morning, and then in the afternoon, the bodies lay in state again. So I attended at the Masala Mosque on day two, this a seven-day program, and I attended at the Masala Mosque on day three. And then on day four, it was the one day that they had set aside for a procession through the center of Tehran, at which people would have an opportunity to follow the coffins of the Supreme Leader and his killed family members to a central square. And I was there as well. I was both down in the crowd and at another point, I was up on a roof overlooking the entire proceedings, the roof of a building at Sharif University. And then I came here to Mashhad. And so far, the bodies of the victims are being, I think they are either just arriving now or they will be arriving shortly for tomorrow, the final day of the funeral. So I saw three full days, Chris. And what I saw with my own eyes was millions of people. Millions of people. I mean, I can't tell you what the aggregate number of people is. And I didn't see what happened in Iraq, by the way. Yesterday, the coffins were in Karbala and Najaf, two holy cities in Iraq. And a huge crowd showed up there. I don't have any reliable information as to their numbers, but I'm just telling, I can tell you what I saw with my own eyes. It was without a question, millions of people. I walked among them. I interviewed them. And I saw countless people overwhelmed with grief. I saw tremendous indignation. Yes, there were repeated chants of death to Israel, death to the United States. There were banners calling for the killing of Donald Trump. There was even a banner that offered a $100 million bounty for Trump, for his head. Not literally his head, but if he was assassinated. Now, I'm not condoning any of this. I'm just telling you what I saw. And so I've seen claims on social media that this was AI. This is utterly laughable. There were dozens of foreign journalists from all around the world. I've met journalists who came in from Japan, from Chile, from South Africa, from Russia, from all over Europe.
Is that, from the United States. Dimitri, is that the Islamic Republic of Japan?
Correct. The one that is predominantly Shia.
So, well, people might be surprised when you say Iraq because of the Iran-Iraq war and some perceived enmity between the neighbors all these years later. Can you explain why there would be commemorations in that country, too?
Sure, because the majority of the population is Shia. And Saddam Hussein, the sometimes Western-backed dictator who launched that war of aggression on Iran, was a Sunni. And he brutally oppressed the Shias. And ever since the Americans, overthrew Hussein, whom they supported in the aggression against Iran, which killed hundreds of thousands of Iranians, the Shia have managed, I wouldn't say that they have a real democracy, not even close to it, but certainly they're not oppressed anywhere close to the same extent as they were before. And they've always been very sympathetic to the Shia of Iran. And they have great respect for the leading spiritual figures within the Iranian Shia community. So this was an opportunity for them to express their real views about Iran. So that's that. When you add up those people, Chris, I mean, I have no doubt, really no doubt, that already in excess of 10 million people have participated in this funeral at one point or another. And by the way, you don't take my word for it. Even Western corporate media outlets like The Guardian acknowledged in, I think, 2 days ago that millions of people had already participated in the funeral, okay? And when it's all said and done, the number, we'll see what happens tomorrow, but the number may be in excess of 20 million, and it may be the largest funeral in recorded history. So to come back to my original point, these facts blow out of the water the claim that the Islamic Republic of Iran has little to no popular support. Now, is it a majority of the Iranian people who support the Islamic Republic? I don't know. It's possible, but certainly tens of millions of Iranians do. And the idea that we're gonna overthrow this government when it enjoys that level of passionate popular support by bombing the country and by subjecting it to sanctions, that's never worked before. And it's not going to work now.
Yeah, I mean it by the point that Ali Khamenei was more than the leader, the supreme leader of Iran, but he's also this leading spiritual figure throughout the Shia religion worldwide.
Yeah, and thank you for stressing that point. I should mention also, you probably are aware of this, that immediately after he was murdered, there were volatile protests in Pakistan, whose population is about 15% Shia. And they got SOA forces killed, I think a few dozen of them. And it's not just in, I've seen people here from India who are Shia. So I've seen people here, I ran into people from Canada who are, they speak with a Canadian accent, they are Canadian citizens, but they're Shia. And in fact, when I was walking in this massive complex today, I was approached by several of them whom I had met a couple of years ago in Toronto. You're quite right. This is a man who commands respect, not just within the Shia community, but outside the Shia community. And so, that's not to say that I endorse everything he ever said or did. I'm just telling you the facts. Those are the facts. And if you want to have an intelligent foreign policy, you have to deal with reality.
Well, and this is like a combination assassination of a country's president, and also not maybe the Pope in Catholic terms, but a high cardinal at least.
Yes, my understanding, I'm just learning more and more about the Shia religion, but my understanding is that he was not considered the most senior cleric, but he was certainly widely regarded from a spiritual perspective, highly regarded, and he was undoubtedly the most powerful of the Shia clerics because he was also the constitutional leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Well, and I'm looking at your site, and again, I'm looking at the Substack, Reason to Resist. That's Reason numeral to Resist. You've done a lot of streeters and features on what's going on, and you can see the grounds of the Masala Mosque, and it's an amazing and impressive, as there are so many of these mosques in Iran are, and other sites, many that have been destroyed by the Americans in the past year as well. What's your impression of being in that space, from a point of view as an individual standing amidst these, not only the throng, but this massive architecture?
Well, I've been an atheist my entire adult life. I was quite well-disposed towards Christianity as a teenager, but my faith stopped on a dime when I was about 18 years old, and I've never looked back. I've never embraced the notion that there is a creator. That being said, I must say that when I am in places like the Masala Mosque, and today for the very first time I saw and entered the Imam Reza shrine here in Mashhad, which is just 100 meters from our hotel, it too is enormous, and it is the resting place of one of the eight imams in the Shia faith, Ali Al-Rida, I believe was his name. He is the only one of these imams who is buried in Iran. 30 million pilgrims come here every year. It is, in fact, the pilgrimage site in Islam that is the most visited. And when I come to these places, even as an atheist, I must tell you, I have, I can only describe it as a spiritual experience. The beauty of these places leaves me speechless. The devotion of the people and this huge, vast throngs of people coming together, bound by their belief in a God of the Muslim faith, it's a very moving experience for anybody who is open to these types of experiences. And I frankly, even as an atheist, I find it quite inspiring to come to these places. I had the same experience when I was in the Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan in 2024, when the genocide had begun. And in fact, as a sign of respect, I managed to gain access to Al-Aqsa one night during Ramadan, and I prayed with my fellow Palestinians. And I hope I don't offend anybody that I did that as an atheist, but I respect the faith of these people, and I also respect the faith of those who are, devoutly Christian or Jewish, and who adhere to the true values of their religions and not to some bastardized version of them, which provides, some depraved justification for things like genocide.
Well, I watched Professor Mohammed Morandi, a very vocal spokesperson for Iran, although not officially with the government. He's on all the shows. You'd recognize him, everyone, if you saw him. He was speaking about the power of belief in Iran as the paraphrase, but as the backbone to the resistance to the American Empire and the West generally, which it must be admitted is an absolute colossus. And for anybody to stand and face it defiantly is a remarkable achievement in itself. But he says that without that faith and belief, it wouldn't be possible for the Iranians to resist. And with it, it's impossible for them not to.
I must agree with the fine professor. And in fact, the one thing that I've learned, you know, I've been to South Lebanon, which is predominantly Shia, six times during the genocide. As I mentioned, I was in occupied Palestine. And although the Muslim population is predominantly Sunni, they, like the Shia, believe passionately in the concept of martyrdom. And of course, I was in Iran twice during this war of aggression. And these are people who believe not only that they are obliged to lay down their lives for justice, they believe that it is the highest honor to lay down one's life for justice. And by justice, they mean not some, corrupted concept of justice coming out of the mouths of Christian Zionists or people like Donald Trump, but rather anti-oppression, anti-imperialism, protection of the vulnerable. That's what they mean by justice, and they think it's the highest honor. And I've heard countless people say to me in this region, Chris, and there's no doubt in my mind that they meant it with every fiber of their being, that they were ready and even eager to lay down their lives for justice and to become martyrs one day. And I'll tell you that even as an atheist, having seen their sacrifices, I feel the same way. I no longer, before the genocide began, I hoped that one day I would die quietly in a bed, calmly surrounded by my family. And while I do want to be surrounded by my family, that's not the way I want to go anymore. I think that it would be a fine way to leave this earth if I was killed by an aggressor while defending the cause of justice. I cannot agree more with Professor Morandi's view about the core strength of the resistance.
Well, Dmitry, we're fast out of time. I'll be joined after the break by Dan Kovalik, who has, I know that you know him and are friends with him and that you were together, if I remember rightly, in Iran. Iran, he cited as being a inspiration for him to pick up his faith. He's a Catholic that had lapsed, as they say, within the religion. But after being to Iran and witnessing the power of their faith, it inspired him to go back to his own church. But thanks a lot for coming on, Dmitry, and we do look forward to your reports again. Go to Reason to Resist. You can find it at Substack or see the videos on YouTube. Thanks a lot, Dmitry, for coming on, eh?
Hey, take care, Chris. Stay safe.
You too. Adios.
Bye-bye. Adios.
That's all I've got for this time. Until the next time.
Before him, he gave of his life so publicly, a sacrifice to gather around, and in every direction you could just hear the sound of